Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. UN votes to approve North Korea's sanctions. The UN Security Council has approved tough new sanctions against North Korea following its latest nuclear test and long-range missile launch. Wednesday's vote came as the Security Council details how North Korea has effectively evaded international sanctions in the last decade. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
At the resolution that is now before the Security Council is among the toughest in the history of the United Nations. And it sends a very strong message, and not just a message, through the actions that it would require. It sharpens significantly the choice that the North Korean regime must face between trying to pursue its nuclear and missile programs or actually re-engaging the world and looking out for its own people.
The report, written by a UN panel that oversees sanctions violations, acknowledges that the four rounds of increasingly stronger UN measures imposed on North Korea since 2006 have failed to persuade the Kim Jong-un government to abandon its nuclear and ballistic missiles program. U.S. Special Forces have captured a suspected Islamic State operative in Iraq. Officials say Americans are interrogating the detainee, who's expected to be turned over to Iraqi officials in the coming days. The suspect was captured by a U.S. Specialized Expeditionary Targeting Force that was sent to Iraq and Syria to target high-ranking ISIS leaders. The targeting force in Iraq was formed following a successful raid last year in which a U.S. Delta Force crossed into Syria and killed ISIS commander Abu Sayyaf. This is VOA News. The United Nations on Tuesday said more than 131,000 migrants and refugees reached Europe via the Mediterranean so far this year. Now, that's more than the total that made the same dangerous journey in the first 5 months of 2015. The European Union website is reporting an emergency action plan to spend upwards of $750 million in humanitarian assistance over a three-year period, making this the first time the European Union will be earmarking financial help for the UN crisis. This is the European Commissioner for Humanitarian and Crisis Management for the EU, Christos Stylianides.
This is to provide basic necessities, including food, emergency health care, shelter, clean water, etc., in close, as always, coordination with member states and by humanitarian organizations, our humanitarian partners on the ground, as always. It is in addition to the funding provided in host countries and in conflict areas.
An estimated 24,000 people, mostly from the Middle East and South Asia, continue to languish at makeshift camps near the Macedonian border. The special UN Syria envoy says he needs a little more time, so he's asked for a delay in the resumption of indirect Syrian peace talks from March 7th to March 9th. Stefan Dimastura says this will allow the cessation of hostilities in force since Saturday to take hold. Although international observers continue to report violations, Dr. Joanne Liu, the international president of the charity Doctors Without Borders, says that there has been a significant decrease in violence.
What our teams are telling us is the fact that there's been a marked decrease in terms of shelling and airstrike in the area. And I'm talking mainly about the northern part. And so as a consequence, what we notice is the number of people moving towards the border has not increased over the last 4 days. On the other hand, the 100,000 of people who are stranded along the Turkish border are not returning back yet to where they're coming from.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. The six-member Gulf Cooperation Council announced Wednesday it has labeled the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah a terrorist organization. GCC Secretary General Abdutalif al-Aizani said the move is linked to Hezbollah's attempts to recruit young people in GCC countries to carry out terrorist acts. He said Hezbollah factions in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq are not compatible with moral and humanitarian values. GCC is made up of six different countries. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wu. Even coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18th presidential poll as tensions there continue to climb.
That's Elizabeth Pollard reporting from Kampala. Details coming up.
Also, Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18th presidential poll. As many as 25,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece after being smuggled across the Aegean Sea from Turkey.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the president of Burundi is expected to attend the summit of the East African leaders in Arusha today. They will discuss efforts to mediate a solution to that nation's political crisis. President Pierre Nkurunziza, whose controversial re-election last year ignited months of violence and displacement of thousands, arrived in Arusha, Tanzania last night for the summit. The East African community has appointed Benjamin Mkapa, a former Tanzanian president, to mediate the Burundi negotiations. The summit is being chaired for a second year by Tanzania. Had it not been for the unrest in Bujumbura, it would have been Burundi's turn to chair the annual meeting.
Former Burundi Vice President Gervais Rufikiri says the African Union has failed to defend African democracy in his country. Rufikiri fled Burundi last year. He said he felt threatened by the government for opposing President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. The former vice president is now living in exile in Belgium. Reporter Moses Javier Amana in Bujumbura spoke with him by phone and has this report.
Burundi's former vice president, Gervais Rufikiri, says that African Union move after the visit in Burundi last week comes with no surprise. The African Union decided not to send the peacekeepers, but did decide to send 100 human rights monitors and 100 military monitors to monitor the current situation in Burundi.
The African Union declaration after five president delegation is something that doesn't surprise anyone, since the African Union lost the courage in the beginning to interpret Article 23 of the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance.
That article condemns illegal means of accessing power. For example, it provides for sanctions by the African Union against the government that comes to power in a coup or that refuses to relinquish power to a winning candidate after free and fair elections. The opposition in Burundi says that last year's elections were not free and fair and that it was illegal for President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for a third term. A high-level delegation from the African Union left Bujumbura last week with a call for renewed dialogue under the mediation of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. But questions remain over who will be included in the talks. The government says it will not meet with anyone in the opposition involved in a failed coup last year to unseat President Pierre Nkurunziza. Critics say the talks should be open to all members of the opposition. Mr. Rufikiri says Burundi currently is not conducting an inclusive dialogue, and what he sees is an internal consultations between the Burundi political actors. He says all political leaders should be given a platform to address the problems in order to find a long-lasting solution. The government cancelled the arrest warrant of several members of the opposition, including Rufikiri, but he says he's still not sure he'll return to Burundi. He said their comments about cancelling the arrest warrant is just a game. He said they released a letter of cancellation of the arrest warrants, but that allegations haven't yet been dropped by the country's Court of Justice. The move to cancel arrest warrants comes in the wake of President's meeting last week with the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. President Pierre Nkurunziza promised that he is to release up to thousands of people arrested during months of political violence and protests. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18th presidential poll as tensions there continue to climb. Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala.
Amama Mbabazi's lawyers managed to submit their petition to the Supreme Court Tuesday, just minutes before the deadline. The petition lays out 28 alleged irregularities, including bribery, late arrival of voting materials, inconsistencies with voting cards, and election papers the opposition said were pre-checked and stuffed into boxes. Mbabazi finished a distant third in the February 18th poll. Results showed President Yoweri Museveni winning a fifth term in office with 60% of the vote. Second-place finisher Kizza Besigye was not able to get a petition into the courts by the deadline. His camp says repeated arrest and detention by security forces made it impossible for Besigye to file a challenge. Besigye, Museveni's main challenger for the past 15 years, previously challenged election results in 2001 and 2006. His party says they will speak to Mbabazi's camp about possibly joining Mbabazi's petition. Robert Karunda, a legal expert in Kampala, says that's unlikely to happen.
I don't think, though, that he will, because I think there have been two principal issues with his going to the court. In the first place, after 2006, he decided to never go back to that court, as he called it, but also because of the handcuffs. I've spoken to his lawyers, and they've told me, man, the challenges are real in terms of what he can and cannot do. And because of those challenges, he figured it's all worth it.
However, if just one count of Mbabazi's petition is ruled in favor, the election can be nullified. This could lead to another election within 30 days. The Supreme Court could also name another winner. Meanwhile, journalists in Uganda are coming under increasing pressure. Twice this week, local television stations have done live broadcasts of police loading journalists into cars and taking them away. Robert Sampala, with the Human Rights Network for Journalism in Uganda, says this trend began before the vote.
Since the campaign season started, we have recorded now over 80 incidents, violations and abuses of media rights and freedoms. This has happened mostly at the hands of security agents, more especially the police, which now works hand in hand with the army. Most of the victims have been journalists that are covering opposition-related activities. Lately, we've now seen a more systematic and cruel crackdown on the journalists, especially those who are covering Besigye in Kasangati. Now we have a total of 17 journalists victimized in about 4 or 5 days.
Police say they are arresting people they deem to be disturbing the peace or inciting violence. However, with most journalists being let go the same day, and most of them without charge, many feel these roundups are a tactic of intimidation. The Supreme Court is expected to hear Mbabazi's petition next week. The court will have 30 days to rule. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
The Associated Press reports that as many as 25,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece after being smuggled across the Aegean from Turkey. An estimated 10,000 are camped out in bad weather near the town of Idomeni along the Macedonian border. The borders have been sealed by the Macedonian government. Meanwhile, a small number of Syrian and Iraqi refugees were permitted entry to Macedonia late yesterday and early today. Yesterday, Macedonian police had used tear gas to break up crowds of migrants and refugees trying to break through the barriers. Speaking in Madrid yesterday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said border restrictions in the Balkans contradict international law and common human decency. Meanwhile, the European Union's humanitarian aid chief is pressing for $760 million to pay for aid to refugees for the next 3 years.
Thank you.
Police in southern Malawi say a mob has burned to death seven men who allegedly possessed human bones to be used for witchcraft. Nsanje District Police Chief Kirby Kaunga says the mob rounded up the victims yesterday and then set them on fire. The bodies were so badly burned that identification has been difficult. Police are investigating but have not made any arrests. Trade in human remains is outlawed in Malawi. However, a lucrative black market exists for the body parts of albinos, which are used in witchcraft rituals in several African countries. Albinism is caused by a genetic disorder that gives people pale white skin and yellow hair. At least six people with the condition have been killed in Malawi since December 2014. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A former vice president of Burundi says the African Union has failed to defend African democracy in his country. Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18th presidential poll. And as many as 25,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece after being smuggled across the Aegean Sea from Turkey. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Former Central African Republic Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadéra has won a presidential runoff. His victory was confirmed today by the Constitutional Court of the Transition Government. Touadéra is a 58-year-old former mathematics professor who campaigned against corruption. He won nearly 63% of votes cast in the February 14th election. The peaceful election is widely seen as a step toward reconciliation after years of sectarian turmoil in the CAR.
There is growing evidence the Zika virus causes a neurological disorder that can result in paralysis. Researchers at the Pasteur Institute in Paris say they found a strong link between Zika and Guillain-Barré syndrome. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The Lancet Medical Journal reports the findings are based on a Zika outbreak in French Polynesia between October 2013 and April 2014. It was the largest Zika outbreak reported up to that time. Lead author, Professor Arnaud Fontenay, says blood samples of those diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, were analyzed. He describes the syndrome as an ascending form of paralysis.
It starts with the feet and then goes up on the legs and eventually can reach the muscles that you use for breathing, I mean the respiratory muscles. And in those circumstances, patients have to be moved to intensive care units for receiving proper respiratory assistance. So this is what is making the severity of the Guillain-Barré syndrome.
About 5% of GBS patients die. Fontenay says it's associated with a number of infectious agents.
The most typical one is a bacteria called Campylobacter jejuni, which gives gastroenteritis. And it was estimated that out of 10,000 patients infected with this bacteria, 2 to 5 would eventually develop the Guillain-Barré syndrome. There have been other infectious agents, mainly viruses like influenza. And when it comes to disease transmitted by mosquitoes, dengue and chikungunya have been known to be able to trigger some Guillain-Barré syndrome.
He says the fact that the Zika outbreak was over when studied and isolated to French Polynesia allowed researchers to gather a lot of data about Guillain-Barré syndrome. The Pasteur Institute researcher says there was a 17-fold increase in GBS cases during the Zika outbreak. Fontenay calls that a massive increase.
Then we were able to collect data from the 42 patients who developed Guillain-Barré syndrome in French Polynesia. And we learned from those patients, first of all, that 88% of them had, 1 week before starting the neurological symptoms of the Guillain-Barré syndrome, a short disease very typical of Zika disease, like fever, rash, conjunctivitis, joint pain.
Further tests over the following weeks strengthened the link. They showed 100% of those with GBS had been infected with Zika.
So when you put together all this evidence, I mean, on one side, the increase in the number of Guillain-Barré syndrome in the population at the time the Zika outbreak goes on, and in all patients, evidence of a recent infection with Zika, you feel quite comfortable that there is a link between the two.
So, does Zika indeed cause Guillain-Barré syndrome?
I would say the only piece which is missing today is by which mechanism the Zika virus would cause Guillain-Barré syndrome. But if we were able to say, well, this is exactly by this mechanism that the Zika virus is triggering the Guillain-Barré syndrome, then I think we would have completed the story.
He says it's a rare complication, 2 GBS cases per 10,000 Zika cases. Nevertheless, cases can quickly add up, as demonstrated in French Polynesia.
As we showed that 66% of the population had been infected with Zika, you can get to substantial numbers. If two-thirds of your population is infected, even if it's a rare complication, well, you end up with 42 patients who have to be hospitalized in intensive care units.
Vaccine research for Guillain-Barré is underway, but Fontenay says it'll be at least 3 years before one is on the market. The professor of epidemiology has some advice for health officials in Latin America trying to deal with Zika. He says once patients show symptoms of Guillain-Barré syndrome, it may take just 4 days before they need to go to intensive care. It usually takes 1 to 2 weeks. The good news is, once the critical phase is over, those patients recover more quickly than normal. After 3 months, 57% of the patients in French Polynesia were able to walk without assistance. It may take some patients nearly a year. Of course, the second major concern with Zika is growing evidence that it's linked to birth defects known as microcephaly that can result in abnormally small heads in babies and other problems. Research continues to confirm cause and effect. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Nigerians depend on trucks, buses, cars, and motorbikes to make a living. But tens of thousands now wait in long queues waiting for a chance to buy petrol at ever-increasing prices. A fuel shortage is fed by corruption and mismanagement in the oil industry. Reporter Paul Okolo in Abuja tells VOA's David Arnold in Washington about gridlock in the streets of the capital and what caused it.
You'll find long queues wherever the product is available, and this often tends to become very rowdy, chaotic. Many roads are blocked, especially if they are narrow roads. They end up being blocked, causing a lot of traffic wherever there is product. Where there is no product, you even find sometimes that some cars are parked in anticipation of getting fuel whenever the product comes.
Is there any fighting or violence?
Once in a while, it degenerates to violence. A lot of cheating takes place. It could result in 50 cuffs at times. It's usually very, very chaotic at best. The same thing is replicated all over the place. There is hardly a station where you have law and order. But in most places, it's very chaotic because you also find people who come in with drums to buy for their alternative source of power, the generators that they use at homes and for their small businesses. Bike owners also come with their bikes. And this usually leads to a lot of rowdiness.
But the president is complaining in Qatar about the glut of oil in the world market. So why is gasoline a problem in this big oil-producing country?
It's very simple. Nigeria produces over 2 million barrels per day of crude oil. Then the refined product is not available locally. Most of what we use in the country is imported from refineries abroad. This is mainly because most of Nigeria's 4 petroleum refineries are down as a result of mismanagement or neglect or corruption or all of them put together. Corruption is very, very central. The problem now is escalated as a result of corruption, bribery, and all other kinds of underhand businesses that take place at the port of entry where the product is discharged, at the point of loading at depots from where they are taken in tankers to different petrol stations all over the country. It takes quite a long time for these products to move from to the interior, say in the north, in Abuja, central Nigeria, and in places like Kano, Kaduna, Maiduguri, and Sokoto up north. It's a lot of complex issues that come together to create this ugly scenario for the country.
What is the price of gasoline now, and how does that compare to gasoline in better times?
The official rate per liter is just about 40 U.S. cents if you use the official dollar-naira exchange rate. But if you go to the pump stations now, you can hardly find it at that level. The best you can get is at $1 equivalent or even more. So people are paying double, triple the official price of a product at the pump price now. Each time this happens, the economy suffers a great deal. Nigeria is largely dependent on petroleum products, primarily for its income generation, is our main revenue earner. And petroleum products are also crucial, and they are the backbone of the economy. People need fuel to be able to run their cars. Nigeria does not have the intermodal transport system that is available in more developed societies. Most of the transportation in this country is done on the road. Having gasoline is crucial. It is needed for people to run their generators, to provide alternative power because of the inadequacy of the public power source. It is very, very crucial for the economy. Whenever there is a problem of shortage, as we have right now, the economy suffers a great deal, and this affects gross domestic product in the end.
That was Abuja journalist Paul Akolo speaking with David Arnold in Washington about the fuel crisis in Nigeria.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yisuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Gidoyuart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A former vice president of Burundi says that the African Union has failed to defend African democracy in his country. Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18th presidential poll. And as many as 25,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece after being smuggled across the Aegean from Turkey. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria. And later, Africa takes a step closer toward the total prevention of HIV transmission. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with African football.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny.
February 29th was the deadline to your quiz, David. Did we have any winners?
We do, Sunny. We have two winners, and ironically, they both have the same surname, and they're both from South Africa. They have the surname of Molo Sankwe, and the Molo Sankwes, a lot of them hail from the northwest province of the country. An awful lot, Sunny, of our listeners who sent answers plumbed for Al Ahly of Egypt. Al Ahly of Egypt have made 27 appearances in the CAF Champions League, or as it was previously known, the African Cup of Champion Clubs. And that makes them, Sunny, number two. Number one, and it was just the Molo Sankwes who picked this up, are Al Hilal of Khartoum in Sudan. 29 appearances. This year will be their 29th time to enter the CAF Champions League. So Al Hilal of Sudan. And the thing is, Sunny, they and Al Marek, also from Khartoum, they have totally dominated Sudanese football. And that means, of course, that particularly Hilal, but also Marek, have made multiple entries into the CAF Champions League. On the other hand, until two entries were allowed from a country, Al Ahly had fierce competition from their great Cairo rivals, Zamalek. So you had occasions where Ahly did not compete in Africa. It was Zamalek. And Ahly, reminder, have won a record 8 Champions League titles. And Zamalek have won 5, a feat they share with TP Mazembe of DR Congo. So the correct answer, Sunny, Al Hilal of Sudan. And thanks very much to all the Sunny Side of Sport listeners who gave us replies. Some that went for Ahly, of course, coming very close. Others were a little bit off the beaten track, but the main thing is there was a lot of interest, a lot of entries, and I really appreciate that.
And our two winners in South Africa will be receiving some of those delightful Voice of America goodies, so watch your mailbox. David, the Swiss-Italian Gianni Infantino, recently elected president of FIFA, World Football's governing body, your reaction?
The man born just 10 kilometers from the birthplace of Sepp Blatter succeeds him. Two Swiss, two former secretary generals, Blatter of FIFA and Infantino of UEFA. Neither were superstars of football on the field, but Infantino has always struck me as a super efficient, multilingual gentleman. And I think we can keep our fingers crossed, but at the same time, I think be pretty hopeful. What Infantino and all of us have seen, Sonny, was just a really sad tale. I don't take any pleasure in what has happened in FIFA in the last year or so. Football has been dragged through the mud time after time after time again. We need a fresh start. And interesting, in his very first day in charge, Infantino organized some football matches, 7-a-side games.
David, what did you think of South Africa's Tokyo Sekwale pulling out just before the vote?
I thought Sekwale was an embarrassment to himself, to South Africa, and to Africa. He had to leave the race, Sunny, after CAF went with the shake, but I don't know whether it was his ego or he was wrongly advised, But in the end, Sonny, he pulled out because I am convinced he would have got zero votes. And he was a dead man standing.
And speaking of pulling out, David, Sunday Olise pulls out as head coach of Nigeria. Your reaction?
Well, this is not good timing, Sonny. Nigeria have got some huge matches coming up against Egypt in the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Only the group winners are guaranteed to qualify for the 2017 finals in Gabon. And as things stand after two rounds, the Pharaohs of Egypt have got 6 points and Nigeria have only got four. So really what Nigeria are looking at is beating the Egyptians at home and trying to at least draw away. If I was a Nigerian football supporter, Sonny, I would be extremely worried. There's certainly a lack of stability. Kessié comes, Kessié goes. Now Olise has been in charge for not a particularly long period of time and he's out. The two main players in this, Sunday Olise and the Nigerian Football Association, have been trading insults and, you know, it's difficult to judge who's right and who's wrong. My sense is always that the truth lies somewhere in between. One shocking thing, though, if it's true, is Olise claims he has not been paid for months. Football coaches are no different from anybody else. If they do their job properly and there are no problems, they must be paid at the end of each month because that's what the butcher, the baker and the candlestick maker do. And football coaches are just the same. Admittedly, they do earn a little bit more than you or I, Sonny. But nevertheless, they must be paid on time. But it's just another sad chapter in the instability of Nigerian football.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Voice of America, VOA,
Washington. Sports? Hear about it first, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports. They're playing basketball.
We love that basketball. March is a big month for college basketball here in the United States. The annual National Collegiate Athletic Association Men's Division I tournament tips off March 15th and will culminate April 4th. When the title game is played in Houston, Texas. The 68-team single elimination tournament is one of the most popular sporting events here in the USA. While the majority of players are Americans, there are some from Africa and other parts of the world. In Division II and Division III college basketball, there are also international players. Ghana-born Kwame Frimpong recently finished his second season for Division III Marymount University, located just outside Washington, D.C., in Arlington, Virginia. VOA's Rick Narciss asked Kwame about his season and his academic program at Marymount.
We just finished our basketball season, and now I'm just concentrating on school, trying to finish strong.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Kwame.
I'm a sophomore at Marymount University. Currently, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, in Rockville specifically. I was born in Ghana, Africa, West Africa. Stayed there until I was about six. Came to the United States and then moved to Gaithersburg, Maryland, and then later to Rockville, Maryland, which I attended Wooten High School over there.
You're a former track athlete, a football player, and you were playing basketball at the time in high school. You know, tell us a little bit about your sports career.
I think I had a great sports career in high school. I was fortunate enough to be a track athlete, basketball, and football, like you said, without getting injured all my 4 years of high school. I'd have to say that it was very time-consuming, but also it was very beneficial because it made me very social. And also I created a lot of friendships and bonds that still help me up to today. So I think that my sports career during high school has really helped me a lot.
Last year, you were on the all-academic team for your college conference. How do you manage to do it all with all the time that sports take and all the time you have to dedicate to the classroom?
Specifically, being a nursing major, it's all the time-consuming, and then adding basketball to the mix is also very hard. But attention to my studies has always been number one. Growing up African, when I was a kid, they used to make me go to the library every summer. Even when other kids were playing, I'd be in the room studying. They really valued education, and that has been instilled in me till today. Check on me weekly to see how I'm doing academically. So I value my education more than everything else, and I spend a lot of time on it, even when I'm outside of basketball.
What do your parents do?
My father is a preacher and a lawyer, and my mother is a nurse.
How has that influenced your life?
My parents have accomplished a lot of great feats in their life that I also like want to accomplish. My mother, she used to be a teacher in Africa, and while she came here and became a nurse, she went back into Ghana and built her own school to support the kids that don't get any education. So she built a school for some of the Ghanaian kids, and I'd be able to accomplish that goal and then go back to Ghana and build hospitals, just play a role and affect my community in the larger role.
Wow, man, that's powerful. What do you hope to accomplish while you're still in school, though?
My first and foremost is obviously to get my bachelor's degree. I definitely want to gain insight on how to accomplish my major goal to become a nurse practitioner, and also like how to translate my job into helping others, like not just in this country, but when I go back to Africa, how to help my other family members or how to help my community down there.
That's Kwame Frimpong, a student athlete at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. And Kwame was talking with VOA's Rick Narciss. Time now for the Voice of America's social media reporter, Andrew Palcheski. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Wednesday?
Well, the big trend is the U.S. Soccer Federation and a new crest that they've released. But it's not so much the crest, although that is getting social media attention. It's more how they released this crest. So what they did was they had 10,000 packages that they sent out to current and former players, friends of the Federation, and registered fans of U.S. soccer. And when they opened up this package, inside was a virtual reality headset, a cardboard virtual reality headset. You put your phone into it, and you play the video. They tell you how to get to this video. And it's a virtual reality video introducing this new crest. Unheard of that they're doing this as a whole new way, not a press conference, not a, you know, a big splashy press release or anything. They're going right to the fans. And after the fans watch that video, there's a little box inside this package with a lock on it. And they have instructions at the end of the video how to open the lock. And inside is a new soccer scarf with the brand new crest on it.
Wow, almost like getting a present.
So cool. I was so disappointed that I didn't get one of these packages. But that's actually speaks volumes about this new way that they're doing this. People who got these packages, sharing them on social media, sharing pictures of the scarves, of the headsets on Twitter and Facebook, and so many fans saying, I wish I got one of these. This is so cool. Just, it's a groundswell of interest in U.S. soccer and this new rebranding.
And you did show me the scarf. You can actually wear it in two different ways.
Yeah, it's got the symbol in the middle of the scarf, and then when you kind of drape it around your neck on either side, it has half of this crest on each side. So when you wear it around your neck, it creates the full crest kind of as a shield in front of you. But a lot of people saying they love the new rebranding, and they love the way that U.S. Soccer Federation has done this. A lot of positive things on social media.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Magnus Chisholm Onwood Dewey, the humble apostle of the Sunny Side of Sports, sent me a Facebook message from Owerri in Imo State, Nigeria. And the humble apostle comments on Sunday Olise stepping down as Nigeria's national football coach. Magnus writes, there is a whole lot of sporty landmines infested here for a coach. And sadly, Olise has become the latest victim, though he escaped with his head partially intact. And Magnus goes on to wish Olise's successor, Samson Siasia, all the best. As the humble apostle so eloquently puts it, coaching Nigeria is a difficult and sometimes unpredictable experience. I can safely predict that Andrew Palcheski has some trends about Sunday Olise.
Oh, absolutely. This has been a social media story from the get-go, starting with Sunday Olise actually announcing his resignation on Twitter. He tweeted out and said, due to contract violations, lack of support, a whole host of other things, I resign as Super Eagles chief coach. And he followed up and said, I feel fortunate, blessed, and eternally grateful for having had the honor to play captain and coach this great nation of ours, Nigeria. So that, right from the start, taking to social media, a huge audience there to release this.
What's been the reaction on social media to this turmoil in Nigeria football?
Well, that's been the interesting thing. It's kind of developed now into this back and forth, where Sunday Alise saying, I didn't get paid for the work I did. The soccer team coming back saying, no, we did pay you. And now we have just today a news organization in Nigeria tweeting out, again, taking to social media to release this to the public, pictures, alleged pictures of what they say are statements that show Sunday Alise was indeed paid. So throughout the course of this, it's really started on social media, developed in social media, and it might end on social media if these pictures turn out to be true. His resignation, his reason might be moot.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And see you on Friday.
See you Friday.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Africa takes a step closer towards the total prevention of HIV transmission. But first, some music. Here is Sunani Kulapo Kuti from Nigeria with Think Africa.
Leadership for boxers, Joe. Whether they fight themselves every day. Instead, they never beat themselves, so they throw share. Tomorrow, now the president, they beat in fights. Army go beat police. Police go beat civilians. Even before we civilian fight, they don't fight themselves for us on our behalf. I beg. Life, don't take your own gospel, my own.
I get my own, you get your own, don't take your own.
Nicola Pokiti from Nigeria with Think Africa.
Well, scientists in Africa say they have taken a step closer toward the total prevention of HIV transmission. Researchers have been studying a vaginal ring containing an antiretroviral drug called dabivirine. Sebastian Mofu reports from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Research findings reveal the dabivirine ring inserted into a woman's genital tract and used for a month at a time reduced the risk of HIV infection by 27% overall. The study, known as ASPIRE, a study to prevent infection with a ring for extended use, was conducted in Malawi, Uganda, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. More than 2,600 women took part in the study between 2012 and 2014. Zimbabwean researcher Felix Mhlanga has coined a phrase, "There is hope in ASPIRE."
There is hope in the sense that we got a prevention agent that is able to avert 1 in 3 infections. We also have hope in the sense that if funds permit, then we should look at, can this ring be taken into full production for use? A lot of the infections are occurring in young women, 60% of them. For once, they have a product that they can use, and you don't really need to explain it to other people. It's not like a condom, which is, you know, you have to negotiate with your partner.
Mutlanga is one of the researchers from the University of Zimbabwe, University of California, San Francisco Collaborative Research Program in Women's Health. The U.S. National Institute of Health funded the research. In a second trial called the Ring Study, HIV risk was reduced by 31% overall and by 37% among participants older than 21. HIV activist Tari Rokutadza said those results make her concerned those under 21 would not use the ring effectively.
I think it's about their attitude. They want to take things like fashion, you know, fashion. Maybe we should have the ring and we should develop another option so that when they are tired using their ring, they can use the another thing. I think that's with the young people. That's where I'm worried, the age group, which means to say we still have a lot of work to do.
Any progress in defeating HIV transmission would be welcome in Zimbabwe and the countries nearby. Estimates say out of the 34 million HIV-positive people worldwide, 69% live in sub-Saharan Africa. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VO editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Developments on the continent 24/7. Visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of Malawi may soon have a significant increase in the electrical power they need, thanks to a new agreement between the United States government and the government of Malawi. Malawian Minister of Natural Resources, Energy and Mining, Bright Msaka, U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, and Power Africa Coordinator Andrew Herskovitz signed a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Malawi regarding Malawi's continued participation in the U.S. presidential initiative known as Power Africa. Power Africa is a U.S. government-led initiative that helps bring critical power projects online and connects people to electricity by removing barriers, particularly the financial and regulatory roadblocks that have stood in the way of power delivery in sub-Saharan Africa. Power Africa represents the U.S. government's commitment to supporting Malawi to achieve its electrification goals and improve the quality of life for thousands of Malawians, said Ambassador Palmer at the signing ceremony. In Malawi, Power Africa support will complement an existing $350 million grant from the U.S. government through the Millennium Challenge Corporation, aimed at expanding access to electricity in Malawi. The United States is proud to partner with Malawi to help meet the country's electricity needs for a better future for the people of Malawi and Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.